Rupert Sims, Africana Studies scholar and theorist, cogently analyzed the methods of domination used against Black females by slaveholders in his essay, Controlling Images and the Gender Construction of Enslaved African Women. Professor Sims observed that there were three main oppressive racist images created specifically for Black females during the antebellum period, and they are Mammy, Jezebel, and the Mule. These three familiar stereotypes had at least one thing in common, and that was how they supported the offense of rape committed against enslaved Black women and girls. This is Dr. Catherine Bankole Medina with The Invention of Racism. The goal of this podcast series is to share the subtle and not so subtle nuances of racism from the past into the 21st century. Understanding and speaking the truth about racism is the first step toward combating and ultimately eliminating it. In this episode, we examine the racist doctrine of unrapeability in United States history. Within the American institution of slavery, it was not a crime to sexually assault a Black woman. Rape was built into the system of white male patriarchy and contributed to the commodification and sale of Black female bodies on the open slave market. Rape was used as a weapon to control African women and the entire Black community. In the American system of slavery, it was legally understood that when rape was perceived as a crime, it was the white male slave owner who was wronged. It is inconceivable to us that there were no legal protections for Black lives, and that the sexual assault of Black women was thought of as a legal form of malice or harm against the slave owner. This meant that the sexual outrages against Black women were substantial. In addition, because of the laws regarding testifying in court against a white person, Black women were prevented from bearing witness to assaults upon their person and those they loved. The system seated white males in positions of judicial power as privileged judges, prosecutors, attorneys, and juries, men who had the latitude to participate in and the power to protect rape culture. Add to this the antebellum racist stereotypes that suggested that Black women and girls were sexually available because they were innately promiscuous. That was the Jezebel type. Now, white males would exploit the bodies of Black females and brazenly claim that their liaisons were filial. But it would be remembered that white males did not have to explain their behavior, a hallmark of white supremacy and privilege. However, when a moral issue was raised and an explanation was deemed necessary, Black females were immediately mischaracterized as wanton seducers of naive, unsuspecting males. This racist ideology allowed white males to practice, conceal, or ignore sexual abuse, and to uphold laws that denigrated the bodies of Black women. However, Black males would be tortured, castrated, and lynched for looking at, speaking to, accidentally bumping against, or writing notes to white females. And this was pre and post Civil War. If discovered, Their consensual relationships with white women almost always resulted in death. At the same time, any male who raped a Black woman or girl was not held responsible or accountable as rapist because antebellum laws protecting women against rape didn't apply to Black people. As Professor Sims explained, Black women were thought of as mammies, Jezebels, or mules. That is, dutiful and servile mother figures, sexually licentious creatures, or workhorses, and yet they could be all of these things simultaneously at the whim of slave owners. The slaveocracy encouraged, enabled, and profited from the sex trafficking of black women and girls. This was supported through the habitual separation of black families, and because marriages among enslaved Africans, when permitted, were not recognized as legal. Black women were bought and sold with the expectation that they would be perfect slaves, meaning submissive in every way. This included, for some, being forced to breed children, in addition to other slave labor burdens. In my book, Slavery and Medicine, I maintain that breeding and concubinage were forced slave labors in the United States and could not be explained as willingness on the part of any woman in bondage. The bodies of black women were disrespected in a way that was unheard of for white women. Black females would be exposed and inspected on the auction block, and they could be sold and taken to various counties and territories within the slaveocracy. Wherever the selling of black women and girls took place, there were no guarantees that they would not be sexually abused and exploited. In fact, it was just the opposite. And there was no punishment for the men who raped them. In addition to the lack of criminal liability for sexual assault, there were no legal consequences for transporting enslaved black women for the purposes of sex. Resistance to sexual assault was considered injury to slave owners. According to one abolitionist account, a white man by the name of Thompson in Courtland, Alabama, shot a black woman in the head at point blank range. Quote, he did it in consequence of some difficulty in his dealings with her as a concubine, end quote. Thompson then buried her body in a pile of logs. One analyst of the period stated that, quote, if the concubine resisted or offered to resist Mr. Thompson's advances, whether revengeful or lustful, she came plainly into the same legal predicament and was lawfully killed, end quote. The point here, in comparison to other slaves who were killed by white men, the law was framed to support the murder of enslaved African people for any reason. This meant that Thompson was legally supported in killing an enslaved black woman in cold blood who resisted his attempt to sexually assault her. One slave owner's son took the wife of an enslaved man. The man protested, and the slave owner's son shot and seriously wounded him. And still, in another case, a slave owner described only as a Methodist attempted sexual assault on a black woman, and she resisted. He beat her and continued to make advances, and she continued in resisting him and was beaten again and again. There was no legal protection for this woman. In yet another example, a black man killed a white man who, quote, owned his wife and was in the habit of sleeping with her, end quote. The black man admitted that he had killed the slave owner for assaulting his wife. He was burned and beheaded, and his head was impaled for public viewing. In Louisiana, there was a vibrant, specialized sex trade in enslaved mulatto females. This was particularly important for places like New Orleans, Louisiana, where enslaved women, quote, were sold at very high prices for the purpose of prostitution or as mistresses, end quote. These females could sell for thousands of dollars. And then there were the breeding centers, some with slave nurseries, developed in Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Missouri. Enslaved black females in slave breeding areas were punished for not producing children. Quote, it is a common thing for planters to command their girls and women, married or not, to have children. and I am told a great many Negro girls are sold off simply and mainly because they do not have children." End quote. As noted, enslaved black women were sexually exploited as either mammies, Jezebels, and mules of the state, and sometimes a combination of these stereotypes. In the infamous case, Missouri v. Celia, a slave, a young black woman killed an older white man in 1855. He owned her, and the court informed Celia that she was property and had no legal right to defend herself against rape. She was tried as a murderess and allowed no defense. Her story is tragic, but within the American slavocracy, it was not shocking or remarkable. Celia's story is the tale of black slave girls who were subjected to sexual assault under the American slave power. In 1850, Robert Newsom, a 60-year-old slave owner who lived in Callaway County, Missouri, traveled to nearby Audrain County to buy a slave. He already owned 5 male slaves who worked on his 800-acre farm. He bought 14-year-old Celia. Now, we don't know much about her other than her first name and her age. During the 25-mile return to Callaway County, Newsom raped Celia. Thereafter, she was sexually assaulted by him for 5 years. During this time, Celia gave birth to 2 children, fathered by Newsom. Now, at some point, she became involved with one of Newsom's male slaves by the name of George. And apparently George demanded that Celia somehow end sexual relations or otherwise stop the sexual assault by Newsom. Celia, who was pregnant for a third time, told Newsom that the sexual abuse must end. He not only rejected her plea, but he asserted his sexual access to her as a slaveholder. Newsom threatened her by letting Celia know that he would be visiting her cabin that night. When Newsom came to her home at 10 o'clock at night and advanced towards her, she struck him on the head. When Newsom fell, she hit him a second time, and that blow killed him. Celia then burned Newsom's body in her fireplace. The next day, an investigation into his disappearance was launched and a search party was formed. When questioned, George told lead investigator that Newsom was last seen headed towards Celia's cabin. In less than 24 hours, Celia was arrested and interrogated. She eventually confessed to killing Newsom and stated that she had done so because he had come to her cabin for sex. 6 months later, she would be executed. Slavery was a great challenge for people of African descent, one that deeply impacted men, women, and children. At 14 years of age, Celia was sold to another slave master, Newsom. We do not know how many times Celia had been sold before he bought her. We know that she had some skill in housekeeping and cooking, but she would be another nameless American woman in bondage, a mule, had it not been for the act of defending herself. But certainly, one aspect of the story that led her to that point was her ordeal as a 14-year-old girl. She was sold to Newsom, who revealed the reason why he had traveled across county lines to purchase her. In this struggle, we assume that Celia was exposed to the rape culture of American slavery for the first time, the white male's de facto legal and presumptive right to sexually assault black females. The struggle would be an ongoing one for Celia. She would spend the next 5 years being forced into sexual situations with Newsom. In addition, This unwanted union produced two of his children, and she was pregnant with a third. The motivation for Celia's bold act of self-defense could have been a combination of incentives. She was no longer a child. She was 19 years old with two small children, as I said, pregnant again. She was an adult woman who had dared to engage in a romantic relationship with a black man, an enslaved man working on Newsom's property. It was possible that George was the father of her expected child, and this was the reason he had pressured her to do something about Newsom's sexual advances. Celia's first awakening towards self-administered justice was the recognition that she would speak to Newsom as an adult and tell him to cease his sexual assaults. It was the crux of the matter. Her understanding that this abuse had defined their relationship and would continue to characterize her life if it did not stop. In Celia's story, often framed as pure victimization, it is important to understand that she asserted herself. It would be part of her plan to be free. Like other black women on what I call the black heroine's journey, Celia assembled her strength to love George and to confront Newsom. For Celia, there was the possibility, the hope, for another kind of life, one of her own making. In the culmination of Celia's story, it is rarely emphasized that she intended to stop, and in fact did so. She did stop Newsom from raping her that night, the night of his death. Newsom had disregarded her earlier pleas to respect her body. Remember, Celia was all alone, with no family and no powerful friends. When Newsom came to her cabin for sex, she defended herself. She stated that it was after the second blow to his head that she lost control. Perhaps she sought to avenge her 14-year-old self. We don't know. Ultimately, she protected her own honor and prevented any future attacks from Newsom. In the American slave patriarchy, who else would stop the abuse against black women? White women could not stop the rape of black females. Often they made excuses for the phenomena by blaming enslaved black women. Yes, utilizing the convenient, lascivious lie of the Jezebel stereotype. Black males, free and enslaved, could not prevent the rape of black women, though we know they tried, and so many died attempting to do so. Slave masters would reward male slaves with sexual access to black women, forcing females to bear children, who would increase their slave holdings. However, this was a coercive form of slave owner rape surrogacy. And, in the case of George, black men, as victims of oppression, could imbue black women with the strength and the power to stop the sexual exploitation of white men. Newsom's death was certainly a blow to the antebellum white male patriarchal culture of rape. We know that black people, black women, were not utterly powerless. Think of it. No one expected Celia, a young, enslaved black woman, to kill Newsom because he had raped her in the past and attempted to rape her despite her protests. And Celia, who knew her fate, courageously refused to implicate anyone else in Newsom's death, including George. She was defended, judged, and tried by powerful white males, and they had no interest or intention of allowing her the defense of rape, a defense which would have been afforded to a white woman. Without this justification, considered sacred among white males, Celia was nothing more than a black slave murderess who would be put to death. Now, at one point, Celia was escaped from custody briefly by her lawyers or liberal friends, and this was for about 2 weeks. But then she was ultimately returned to jail. It was an impromptu protest intended to get Celia's case heard before the Missouri Supreme Court. The Missouri Supreme Court ultimately rejected her appeal, but I can't help but to recall that several years earlier, in about 1839, long before Celia's case, and this was in South Carolina, there was the rare circumstance, very rare, of a white man who was convicted of murdering a slave, and he was sentenced to death. However, the day before his execution, he somehow escaped from prison. No one told the story of his escape or gave any information of his whereabouts. There were no reward notices posted for his apprehension, and he was not returned to prison and was never executed for killing this black person. Yet Celia's case is often described as little more than a tragic and horrible story of the American slaveocracy. However, we cannot forget that her story was not new, not at all. It can't be reiterated enough. It was part of the system of rape culture in the slaveocracy, and certainly not the only documented account of an enslaved black woman who retaliated against a slave owner. So Celia's story is more than heartbreaking. Self-defense and self-justice reflected the powerful choice that some black women exercised. By the time Celia was executed on December 21st, 1855, she had recognized and taken back her power. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Support for independent podcasts like The Invention of Racism is critical at this moment. In the national and global effort to dismantle racism and to establish human equality, we need as many thoughtful and courageous voices as possible. If you believe in and appreciate this anti-racism podcast, continue to download, like, share, and support us. And I also encourage you, as I always do, to use your media platform to honestly analyze, examine, and to put an end to racism. If you are listening to this podcast series, then you already know. Discourse on racism is not for the faint of heart. I hope you will continue to join me as I present key topics in The Invention of Racism.